Welcome to the San Diego Psychological Association's podcast, Diving into Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Carcel. This podcast has been developed with the intent to inform and educate the general public and providers and should not be relied upon for any other purpose. The content, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker and not those of the San Diego Psychological Association. I'm so excited today. We will be talking about a very important and specific topic, school to prison pipeline, what it is and how it impacts students and our children. I'd like to welcome our guests today, Dr. Ricky Pope and attorney Alex Cannon. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Wow. Yes. Michelle, thank you for having me.
Good morning, Michelle. Thank you.
Yes.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. You know, I really like to pride myself on being up to date with a lot of topics specifically of that affect diverse populations. That's just something, as someone who's categorized myself as a marginalized person, I try to keep up to date with these things. But this particular topic, I was floored by the statistics of the school to prison pipeline information that I was reading. And I could not be more pleased to have you both elaborate, discuss, and educate some of our listeners. Some people might have a lot more information and understand it, while others, I believe, may not. I personally don't understand how this isn't being talked about more on the news, how we're not hearing more about this. I think what we'll do is let's just start by, you know, giving the information and kind of taking it away from there. But I thought we could start with, what is the school to prison pipeline?
Go ahead, Ricky.
Okay, then. So it's this phenomena where students are funneled out of schools and into the criminal justice system, typically through zero tolerance policies, which are used, you know, if a student does any kind of minor infraction, they can get suspended, expelled, and kind of pushed out of the school system. And then you have police intervention, which can lead them to juvenile justice systems. And so a lot of these policies emanated in the early 90s as a response to, I don't know how I would explain, like this social political narrative, right? Driven by the national media, social scientists, politicians that were worried about super predators and these predictions that there's going to be a generation of young men that would wreak violence within the communities, which didn't come true. Crime actually dropped, which we now have, right? But it's the everyday lived experience of going to school and being in communities where folks thought, you know, maybe you were going to do something. I wonder if it became a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Like pushing these students out. And so that's what I would say.
Yeah. And I believe the purpose of it, from what I was reading as well, was in the 1990s, it was to prevent drug use and gun violence in school settings. But again, as you said, that there wasn't a correlation that we could find that actually where this worked, where this was something that actually was beneficial. So it is pretty interesting, you know, how this, and we can elaborate and talk about it more. But I believe that the effects of this came from these zero tolerance policies. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on what zero tolerance is?
So it's political, federal legislation, right? So that if you brought a firearm or had illicit substances in school, you would be expelled for up to a year. And it's the whole idea behind it. And then if the zero tolerance policy wasn't enforced, then schools could lose federal funding as well, right? And so these policies were promoted to prevent drug use and violence in all schools. But then what happened would be like for like minor infractions that in the past would have been a simple visit to the principal and a talking to, or, you know, maybe counseling or something like that, now resulted in being harsher discipline. And then having officers handcuff, remove students from schools. So it's really, you know, just through actions and behaviors are criminalizing, you know, youth when they're having, you know, a bad day, which could be related to a whole host of reasons why someone's struggling. And so maybe they're needing some scaffolding or some additional support or counseling, but it's met with a harsh, swift, disciplinary, punitive kind of punishment that leads a lot of students into the criminal justice system.
That's an absolute shame. I actually read a heartbreaking story in relation to this. it was basically a teenager that was sitting at his lunch, and he had received some news that his girlfriend was pregnant. Mm. And while he was sitting there at the table, he was in complete shock and just needed some time to process this information. And as he sat there, the time escaped him, and you know, he couldn't make it to class. He was really just emotionally distraught. And he's describing this story and what had happened. And as he was sitting there, one of these security people came up to him and said, you know, you're not in class. And basically the disciplinary action was so harsh that they ended up expelling him for something that was such an emotional moment where he needed support, needed to have that discussion with someone to give him that emotional processing opportunity. And instead he was punished. And I couldn't believe reading this and several stories similar to this and the consequences of this and the fact that there were security and police instead of counselors, instead of people to nurture and assist. That was shocking to me to read that. This is, again, newer information for me personally. I didn't realize the severity of these zero tolerance policies. You know, conceptually, I can understand that, yes, we're trying to make corrections. Of course, we want to help. But this reminds me a lot of parenting styles. Mm-hmm. If we think about like authoritarian parenting or authoritative parenting or permissive parenting. Now, the three differences, the primary that I'm thinking of is authoritarian. This is a very punishing style of parenting. And what we often see is children who have authoritarian parents end up having a lot of mental health concerns. I mean, anxiety, depression. We see all types of also violence, bullying. You know, we see them taking, going to another level that they don't need to go through versus authoritative parenting, which is a more caring, warm, concerned form of parenting where we're talking to the kids, we're guiding children. And the differences are stark. We see that authoritative parenting has very successful outcomes where children feel heard, they feel supported. And if they are going through something, they're not afraid to voice it because there will not be corporal punishment as there is with authoritarian type parenting. So I think that and permissive parenting is a whole nother, you know, that's where we're just not even taking care of our kids, which that seems like is kind of falling into this too. So that came to mind for me. All of that came to mind for me when I was thinking about this zero tolerance policies. I mean, this is just very authoritarian and very harsh on kids. I'm just curious, any thoughts on that?
It kind of comes back to what I told Ricky when I first met him. We met at a presentation, a panel presentation at Mesa College. The first thing, one of the first comments I said was, from my experience, I said, I wish a lot of my clients would have met Ricky beforehand, right? So I do believe intervention is necessary. I think holistic intervention is necessary. I think eclectic intervention is necessary. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all. I think there's a lot of good work that can be done before the legal system gets involved, because when the legal system gets involved, the odds are stacked against you pretty much. So we need more people like Ricky. We need more, you know, health professionals. We need more planning in terms of addressing issues that come up with the kiddos, as I call them, not to discount small comments that are being made, you know, not to jump to a law enforcement type mechanism on the defensive. Because I mean, a young man can be one step away from, you know, having a PhD or going to jail. So I think there's a lot of potential out there with a lot of the kids. And I think, you know, a lot of them unfortunately don't have the stable household. And that's where I think it's necessary. So it's just one person can make a big change in your life for the better. So sometimes we need that push.
Yeah, and I think even Michelle, like returning to the story and how you're kind of laying out this young man, you know, with the breakup and he's in this emotional distress, right? And so needed help and just someone to talk to. Like, man, it's going to be okay. You're going to get through this. You know, you'll date somebody else. But then it's like you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. But there's no additional assessment of understanding why. And so for me, like the one of the clearest studies is the study about teacher expectations. And so when we expect our kids to show up and do good, then they do so. And when we expect them to be quote unquote super predators and we label them that way, right? We're expecting poor behavior, then that's what manifests. And so it's really, I think it's providing those social supports, that affirming environment, and also holding, you know, high expectations for the students and wanting them to achieve their best. But it's like, man, you're not in class. So why aren't you in class? Right. And it's just assuming that, man, I'm going through something here. And so just not really getting that support.
Absolutely. And Ricky, for you, this is a personal story, isn't it? I'm curious, how has your lived experience been influenced by the school to prison pipeline?
Wow. I mean, it's been mainly shaped by that. And it's so, so broad. I really don't know where to start. Like, a lot of what I've been able to understand about, like, my life has been through, like, the research that I've gotten and then retrospectively looking back. So, for instance, I went to Montgomery Middle School here in Linda Vista in San Diego, and I was suspended, expelled from school. And for 2018, 2019, a third of Black students are suspended from the school. So it's still happening, you know, 20 years later. And so I don't know. So, I mean, it's just so striking to me. Like, it's like, okay, like, I want to support students and bring awareness to this topic, because, right, that's our future, you know, the kids there, and we all have to live together. And so when we're, you know, right, like the core of the zero tolerance, and this is, your students are missing instruction time, right? Like, you're being suspended, expelled, and often for, like, emotional distress, and you need a counselor, you need a caring adult person to talk to, and you're not getting that support, you're not getting the scaffolding, right? But it's just that you're being criminalized and disciplined. Yeah, I just think that is unfortunate that it's even still, like, I often thought that, man, like, this is my experience alone. And I didn't know, like, it's still happening today, and that there's, like, generations. Like, I had a friend who is a clinician, and we were sharing our stories of, you know, how he got through to the graduate degree. And when he was recounting his middle school and high school experience, I was like, are you in my brain? Like, are you, like, word for word, like, his story was so similar to mine. So, I mean, I feel like, luckily, I got the support that I needed, and I'm able to tell this story and kind of reach back and give some guidance and some things that, you know, maybe our education system can do differently and make parents and folks more aware of kind of what's going on in the schools.
Yes, I agree. And I think for me, one of the statistics that really floored me is the disproportion of minority students that are being targeted by this zero tolerance policies. I read in one of the analysis that Black students are suspended and expelled at a rate 3 times greater than Caucasian or identified white students, while Black and Latino students, or let's say Black and brown students, account for 70% of police referrals. 70% of police referrals. That is something I didn't expect. And, you know, it's ironic because in my mind, in the back of my brain, I understand that. I know that, you know, being a multicultural psychologist, I have all of this literature and data. It's really, that kind of floored me how disproportional that's occurring. And it's not just Black and brown. It's also, I want to include LGBTQ plus that are also in that category. We're seeing biases targeted towards them. Also disproportional to men, males versus identified males versus identified females, but also transgender are being targeted. This is so significant, you know, and that we need to get this information out there, and that there is a component here of structural racism.
Correct. And no, absolutely. So, you know, the U.S. Department, they do this survey every couple of years here. And so for 2020, we know that 79% of all public school teachers identified as non-Hispanic white, only 7% were non-Hispanic Black, and 9% were identified as Hispanic. And so you have a workforce that may not have the awareness, skills, knowledge to work with, you know, a diverse population of students. And so then it's, you know, if I zoom back to my narrative, you know, of the time where I was kind of coming through, right? Like, you have the news, you have the politicians that are worried about, you know, these black and brown students that are, so it's like, nope, you can't do anything. Like, you did something, right? And it's just this normal acting out that, you know, kids do, right? And they just, they do things that students do in schools. But when it's black and brown students, you know, behaviors are criminalized and you're pushed out. And so I think it may be this implicit bias, like without understanding and going into the mind of every student, of every teacher, I don't know for sure, but it feels as if that's this unconscious bias, microaggressions, where we feel unsafe and we don't know how to teach these students. So let's get them out of the classroom and send them somewhere else.
Right. This is a passion project for both of you. From what I understand, you're both working on a film. And I believe the film is called Pope, and it captures these themes. Alex, I'd like to ask you, it sounds like you're really wanting to produce this. And can you touch on a little bit of what this film will be?
Yeah, sure. So it's going to be, it's loosely based on Ricky's life. Ricky's life is going to be the springboard for it, for the story. And it's just going to tell a story about a young black man who is dealing with a lot of anger when he's young, and he meets a mentor, and the mentor changes his life. And he, instead of going down a path of trouble, he goes down to a path of success, and he morphs into Ricky today. So I'm really passionate about, you know, I'm a lawyer by trade, but I'm very passionate about film and documentaries. My last movie was about the life of a transgender person in Mexico. So I'm, to me, two things that are important in the filmmaking process is to tell a story, a unique story, and also touch on an important social topic, because we're living in a society where everyone has an opinion, everyone's a preacher, everyone's a psychologist without doing all the heavy lifting and doing all the studying and doing all the hard work. Anyone can get on Facebook and Twitter and just say something and then they get a bunch of followers. So we're kind of living in an age of misinformation by plenty of unqualified individuals. So it doesn't do any good to just get up there and say your opinion, because someone's going to agree and someone's going to disagree. And so that's why I think art's important. And I think this is the one thing that's been timeless to the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, propaganda, communism in China, World War II, Vietnam War. Art was always an important form of expression. So what I want to do with this is just, I want to kind of scratch my artistic itch by being able to, and that gives me an opportunity to take the stress of work and the kind of, you know, the day-to-day happenings of work, but we also get to tell a story at the same time. So that's what I'm hoping to do with this. This is bigger in scope than my last project. But my important thing is to just always keep it real and tell an authentic story from the heart.
Oh, that's wonderful. I cannot wait to see this. It's very moving. I'm familiar a little bit with part of your story, Ricky, and, you know, even recent events that have occurred to you as a psychologist working at a university and having on a day that you were lecturing about racial disparities and, you know, you actually had a run-in with police. There's a lot to tell, and I'm excited to see that final production. And thank you, Alex, for doing that, because I think these are the types of stories, these are the types of messages that people need to hear and see. And I want to come back to me, it's a critical point, is, and I think both of you have said it directly in your own way, but education. You know, education. A lot of times, it's just sitting in a room with a person that you have no background, you know, you're not familiar with, and just hearing their story and recognizing that story is so different than our own. And that can change us, that can help us evolve and grow. And I think, you know, there was a lot of punitive actions in our past and in our recent history that I think people thought they had good intentions. But when you don't know people's stories and you don't understand where they're coming from, the repercussions could be vast and yeah. Terrible. So this is just great. I'm really looking forward to seeing when this is completed. That's quite exciting. And Alex, I wanted to stay with you for a second. You were talking about how you wished people had met a therapist like myself or like Ricky before reaching you. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means? Like the clients who are reaching you, what's going on? What's happening there?
Well, by the time they come to my office, well, we do immigration, criminal defense, and car accident cases. With regards to the criminal defense cases, by the time our caseload consists of a lot of individuals who they experienced an aberration and they acted out of character and they made a mistake. They're everyday folks who just, don't have any specific psychological diagnoses that would make them more likely than not to commit a certain act. They don't have a predisposition to commit it. They just had a bad day. They made a mistake, right? So that's a big component of our caseload, right? Another section of our caseload are, you know, folks who, you know, this is not the first time they've had run-ins with the law. So by the time you get to the legal system, it's too late. Sometimes people unfortunately don't learn, and then they just wind up coming back. The judge says, I've seen you. It's the second time I've seen you again. You're getting a DUI while you're on probation for the first DUI. So, you know, now I'm going to send you to jail. It's not going to help anybody. But at the same time, at this point, this person, you don't want this person driving on the road. You don't want this person continuing to smuggle drugs across the border. Just, and you get used to a life of crime, and that's all they know. Easy money, especially now with COVID, times are tough. Mm-hmm. So just, but these individuals met, you know, individuals like yourself before, you know, they had the proper guidance. They wouldn't be doing that. I mean, my friend, he was a high school dropout. He was involved in gangs and tagging. And then one day he met someone who, while he was working at Jack in the Box, he met this person. It was a customer at Jack in the Box. This person would wind up becoming his mentor and turn his life around. Now he runs a successful law practice with 6-7 employees. So he could have been in the, you know, he grew up with no parents.
Wow.
And going back to another important part, which we haven't really touched on yet, is because the system isn't really helping these folks, and because they don't have anything better at home, gangs are the answer, you know, because here's a group of people who actually listen to me. Here's a group of people who have my back. It's unfortunate, because then they just go and they commit crimes. You know, they don't go and do volunteer work and help people. It's just, you know, a lot of misdirected anger and energy. And then that energy can be used for, you know, to do something beneficial. Energy can be used to, Ricky's program is really telling, because you have a bunch of young men who write poems, you know, or, you know, start businesses. You can do a lot. There's a lot of that energy can be redirected for, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For good.
I completely agree. Yes. And I'm glad you brought the part up of anger, you know, especially for young men, young boys, women too. I don't want to genderize, but there is something to be said for, if we give the tools and we teach and we do right by these children, that we won't see the outcomes that you're probably seeing. I hate to say this, you might be out of a job, but in a good way, or you might switch, here. That's not a bad thing though, right? I often tell people too, if I go out of a job, that means everybody's, you know, is got skills and they're doing well mentally. I'm okay with that. I'll find something else to do. but there's something to be said for the work that's needed to give that redirection. And also, you mentioned COVID-19. I am curious about that with the pandemic. How has the pandemic influenced the school-to-prison pipeline?
From the few studies that I could see, it was still happening. There's, you know, some cases in there. One of the ones that kind of stood out to me was a student who was working to complete homework online. And because they didn't get their homework done, it was a violation of their probation. And then so now they're in trouble with the law, right? Because of school. And so it's like, that should be a mechanism of that corrects them, scaffolding. What's going on? Why aren't you completing your work? How can we help you? But instead, this leads to a criminal offense. And so that stuff stays with you, and it shapes what you're able to do in society, right? Like, once you get that record, you get, you know, the more likely that you're involved with police, the more likely you're going to jail or prison. So simply reducing contact with the legal system ensures that people don't go to jail and have, you know, criminal offenses. And so one thing that I kind of heard Alex alluding to, I would frame as like positive youth development.
Yeah.
And so there's this push for counselors and for like creative staffing and programming. And so one of the studies that I've looked at, it's called the Young Adult Diversion Court. And so you had these students with misdemeanors who were pushed out of high school for, you know, getting in trouble for some reason. And now they're in this court setting, and you have the judge, you have some programming, and it was just a fascinating program. So they would feed the kids. So you go to court, you meet with the judge, you meet with the probation officers, but then outside of the court program at this county building, we would have spoken word artists who would come in and other trauma-informed care providers. And the students would sit around this table, you know, about like 10 to 15 students, and they would talk about their lives and just talk about some of their challenges. And just to sit there with young folks and to hear some of the stories of the past and what led them to the court involvement, but then also their hopes for the future. And so through the creative expressive arts, these folks were able to start making sense of their trauma and then articulate a vision for the future. So from that work, for me, I just really see the power of caring adults. And that's what Alex said in his friend's story, right? Like having that mentor. And it's just, it takes one good mentor to kind of alter the trajectory of folks' lives. I needed more than one mentor, but it's just having good people in your life to shift, you know, the possibilities. And so for me, I wonder why can't that be something that happens, you know, in middle school, high school, having more counseling or having supportive adults, right? Like, what are we doing with these retired folks? Can we get some of them in the schools, being there to help, you know, teach people and just, hey man, so you had a breakup with the girl. Oh man, that happened to me before, right? And so to really, like, if that security officer in the story you were telling earlier, Michelle, could have really sat down, you know, with the student and really heard what he was going through, it may not went in that direction,
right?
But your high school, we know about the brain, the prefrontal cortex isn't all the way developed until the mid-20s. Yep. So it's just like, it feels like, oh my gosh, this is it. I'm never going to find anybody else to love again. It feels like these high stakes things, but your whole life is still ahead of you, right? But you can't see that, you know, in high school. Mm-hmm. And so like one mistake, one time of acting out potentially could alter the trajectory of your life and push you towards this school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And so I think really it's intervening early in the lives of young people and having caring, supportive adults who can really connect with students and help them see that there's more possibilities than this narrow scope in the moment that feels that way.
Oh, I completely agree. You know, to add to that, some of the statistics that I was reading, and Ricky, you so kindly provided me with some of this information as well. And Alex, I think you were part of that. But, you know, the legislation, the good news, you know, what we're talking about here is truly I'm going to use the word crime of what we're doing to children with the zero tolerance policies. We're taking this, again, I'm going to go back to parenting, this authoritarian approach, which we know is ineffective for parenting styles. Why are we doing this in schools? You know, why are we doing a similar type of outcome? But again, you know, the past is the past, and we're in the present trying to change the future. But one of the things to me that was fascinating and scary was that there are more police officers at campuses than there are counselors, nurses, psychologists. I want to read this out because there are guidelines, you know, there are professional standards that require that there's at least a counselor or a social worker for every 250 students and at least one nurse or one psychologist for every 750 students. This is, to me, that's still too low, but okay. Mm-hmm. But what we found in the statistics, and Ricky and Alex, you can speak to this, but 1.7 million students attend schools with police officers, but not a single counselor.
Yeah.
That is crazy to me. 3 million students attend schools with police, but not a nurse, not one school nurse. 6 million students attend schools with police and no school psychologists. And I mean, we can go on here, but 10 million students attend schools with police and no social workers. What is going on? How is that the norm right now? I did not know that. I did not have that information. So to me, that really spoke to the lack of prioritization mm-hmm. on the effectiveness of what we need to be doing for kids. But I read that and I was like, okay, we got to do something. The good news is we're working on it. It sounds like there's legislation that's happening. I'd love to hear from both of you about that. So please tell us the good news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the Counseling Not Criminalization in Schools Act. And so for me, I'm just reading that. I'm just like, this is a no-brainer to pass, right? But I think it goes back to this narrative of expectations. So it's like we need officers and, you know, security versus counselors, nurses, psychologists, and social workers. And so it's really a shift to how do we bolster and support students? And I mean, and with COVID and, you know, as they're called, the twin pandemics,
yeah.
Right? Like it's just like we need supportive folks in our schools and in our communities, right? Like that should be a priority.
Is this something that has to do, and we could talk a little bit, I'd like to hear again a little bit more about like the legislation aspect of it, but is this something that has to do with federal funding? Is this local state fund? What is it that we can afford police, but we can't afford the basic needs of what students need, which are, again, counselors, nurses, psychologists? So what's going on there? I guess I'm confused there.
You know, for me and my work, I can just talk about it from the perspective of being a psychologist on university counseling campuses. So across California, I've worked at a couple different places and in Michigan as well. And so I would have first generation students that would say either one, I didn't have a counselor in my school, or there weren't that many counselors, or even my parents didn't believe in therapy and spreading our business around, you know, for lots of concerns, some with, you know, they don't have legal status in the U.S. So they really don't want to have people in their business, but they need help and support. And so I think it's this idea that, you know, like I need someone to talk to, but I haven't been able to talk to anybody. So they get to college and right, like they're ready to find a therapist, to find someone to support them. But they've been doing this, you know, through K through 12, 18 years of not having the support and help that they need. And somehow some of these folks make it here. Right. And so they're trying to start off, you know, their first year as college students, but they've had all this trauma that has went unaddressed. And so I think it's prioritizing, like we know that things are happening to students early and really having counselors, therapists, social workers, and supportive caring adults early in the development, I think is paramount to helping students support and really foster their full growth and human potential. So I don't know. So to me, like, I don't know what the debate is, right? Like, it's just like, this is our future. So what's preventing us from maximizing this? And then what I was going to say is following COVID, right? Like it's this trauma, people are in the house. Like it's just, people need to talk, right? People need support and positive development and programming. I mean, it's just, in my mind, it's a no-brainer.
I had a question regarding legislation. I don't know, Alex, can you speak to that? I mean, are we seeing legislation being passed or going forward to try to change this narrative, to try to work on the zero tolerance policy being eliminated and then bringing in more mental health support for kids? Are we seeing that?
I don't have any intel on that. I'd defer to Ricky if he knows anything about that, because I don't.
Yeah, just the recent proposed legislation, I believe it went to the Senate or the House, and it's funneling through. So I hope it gets passed. It's, Counseling Not Criminalization in Schools Act. So yes, the Senate, S-2125. So it's pending legislation. Call your senators and you know, tell them to pass this legislation so that our kids can get the support that they need. And so while, you know, the topic that we're here to talk about is the school to prison pipeline, right? But we know that there's a host of issues affecting and influencing young people. And so we need these numbers are probably too low, you know, in terms of the counselors and social workers and helping professionals that we need in our schools. And so, I mean, honestly, this is a no-brainer to pass this legislation and obviously to push for more like support and help in the schools. And I guess what I would argue for, like based off my research and work and seeing what creative artists could do, like, so you have, you know, it's just like the spoken word and creative expressive arts is such an easy, not easy, but it's a accessible way to influence youth, and there's therapeutic effects, right? And so it's like, if I'm talking about, like, one of the things I would do would be to show Antoine Fisher to my young adult men. And that was like, oh, like that happened to me, right? But when I started, I, well, tell me how you feel. They don't want to talk to me, right? But when they could talk about Antoine Fisher and then describe that my life kind of is like that, and I have some anger, right? And then it was this, so the arts, movies, film are avenues to talk with young people about what's going on. The spoken word, the creative expressive arts, dance, movement, therapy gives youth a way to work through their traumas, through their difficulties, through their fears. And I believe when done so with caring, supportive adults who've had similar struggles, who are open to self-disclosing some of their things, the youth often are like, man, wait, so you Dr. Polk, like, you got in trouble, but you became a, like, how's that possible? Right. And so it opens up the possibilities, like, right. Representation matters, and having caring adults that look like them, or caring adults who are trained to work with youth and can really access what's going on. I think that's what is needed. So I would add to that bill, if I have the power to do so, positive youth development counselors that are trained as musicians, spoken word artists, but just that can access trauma and really allow youth to make sense of the difficulties that are in their lives versus punitive mechanisms. Mm-hmm.
Completely agree. And I'm so glad we're talking about the expressive arts. I know, Ricky, you have done amazing work here and really channeled some fantastic artistry out of the students that you work with. And I think that is really key especially for children who don't have the knowledge yet of how to verbalize their pain or how to verbalize their hurt or what they're experiencing. Expressive arts and art therapy, and whether it's movement therapy or, you know, play therapy, whatever we're discussing in this realm, that it can be very productive and very effective to start that healing process. And I am glad that we're seeing, you know, some of this move through our Congress and Senate, and that we're working on the bills that need to be passed in order to do right by these children, by our kids. These are all of our responsibilities as adults to take care of the kids effectively. And again, having resources that are effective and work is what we need. And having, you know, punitive and corporal punishment for things where children don't understand yet what they're even going through is an outrage, in my opinion. Children need guidance. They need love, support, warmth, and connection. And I think, Ricky, the way you said it, that, you know, seeing people who've been through it, whether it's a story, whether it's a movie, and Alex, you're making your documentaries, whether we're talking about it in that level, that they can say, hey, it's not just me. I'm not alone. And that is fundamental. And if, for anybody who's listening who feels this way, you're not alone. You know, I could say so many things that I've read, you know, just on this, the wonderful opportunity that both of you have presented to me. It shocked me that even kids with learning disabilities are being punished because they're not being accurately diagnosed, and they're having, you know, punishment instead of opportunity. Kids with learning disabilities, dyslexia, these are fundamental things that children don't mean to do or have, and we're treating them like criminals, and that has got to stop. So I'm hopeful for the future. I love that you mentioned the Counseling Not Criminalization in Schools Act. If I'm reading this correctly, it's S-2125. So for anybody listening who wants to advocate, this is the time to do it. You know, let's definitely get our voices heard. You know, I do have hope for the future. I think we all do here, hopefully, that we're talking about it, we're getting the knowledge out there, and that we can reform some of these very punitive, ineffective policies that have been in place that need to change. Any final thoughts? Any additional thoughts?
Well, I just wanted to say this quote from Complex. He's a local San Diego artist, and I think his track, which does have some explicit language on it, but it's called "I Ain't Lying," and it's and then this one little quote in the song says, "Schools ain't preparing us. Teachers all scared of us. Suspend me, expel me, fail me, then jail me." And so I think it just really speaks to like this period of time. But unfortunately, when I sat down with this young man that is, you know, 10 years younger than me, and his story just really mimicked my story, I knew I had to do more, you know, with this topic and speak to this more and just really try to educate the public and, you know, through sharing our narratives, right? That's what I really learned with the young people. Like when they could tell their stories, right, then they recognize that this is just one chapter in their life and there's more chapters yet to be written. And so that's what I just think the stories and narrative is so powerful. And so Michelle, I just really appreciate you having me on the podcast and I really appreciate my good friend Alex, you know, for helping to tell this really, really important story through documentary. And I look forward to when that's produced. Maybe you can have us back on and we can talk about that. So,
absolutely. It would be my pleasure. Alex, any final words?
Yeah, no, I would just say thank you, Michelle, for having me. Ricky, it's always nice to see you. Tammy, thank you for having me as well. And yeah, I just think our art is important. I think art's all we have left in the world right now. I think in the age of misinformation, social media, and lack of attention, all we have left is art. So I encourage anyone to express himself or herself through art.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much for being on the show. And yes, we will have you back. I'm so excited to talk about this because it's so needed. And we'll have some resources posted at on the podcast as well, some of the reports and information so people can read up on this. And once again, thank you, Ricky and Alex, for being on the show. It's a pleasure. And I look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
The information and advice offered is not intended to treat or diagnose and is not meant to replace any other professional consultation. If you'd like to know more about the San Diego Psychological Association, go to our website at sdpsych.org. That's sdpsych.org. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, take care of yourself and be well.